The deadliest cholera outbreak in Africa in 15 years, slowing, the UN's World Food Programme has warned of a pressing emergency, with 7 million Zimbabweans needing food assistance. Coupled with the deepening humanitarian and political crisis, Zimbabwe's central bank governor admitted defeat in the face of galloping inflation and authorised the use of foreign currencies alongside the worthless Zimbabwe dollar. Ofebia Kwistarkton, NPR News, Accra.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is reminding wealthy nations weighed down by the global financial crisis, don't neglect the world's poorest people. He made that plea once again at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by a grant from Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the National Acrobats of China, displaying signature precision and envy-inspiring agility on February 10th and 11th. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Yesterday, the Illinois State Senate voted unanimously to remove Governor Rod Blagojevich from office and also to bar him from holding future office in the state of Illinois. Shortly thereafter, the lieutenant governor, Pat Quinn, was sworn in as the new governor of the state of Illinois. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about the impeachment of Rod Blagojevich and also look at some of the challenges that lie ahead both for the legislature and also for Governor Quinn. And we have two guests with us this morning who have spent many years following Illinois politics, Taylor Pensno and Kent Redfield. Taylor Pensno is a former Illinois State House political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch newspaper. He has also authored biographies of Illinois Governors Dan Walker and Richard Ogilvie, and also Illinois State Senator W. Russell Arrington. He's also served to update and revise Robert Howard's book, The Illinois Governors, Mostly Good and Competent. Kent Redfield is professor of political science at University of Illinois. He's also interim director for the Institute for Legislative Studies. He also serves on the board of directors of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform. He is joining us by phone. Both, in fact, of our guests are joining us by telephone. And as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. And I'm sure the two of them would do their best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. Otherwise, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the first number applies, 333-9455, and a toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Mr. Pensno, hello.
Good morning, David. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. And Professor Redfield.
Yes, good morning.
Thank
good
you both. Both of you, I know, have been generous with your time before and have been on our air before. And we want to say thanks very much for giving us some more of your time. We appreciate it.
Sure, certainly.
Well, as a way of starting out, I guess I would just ask for your general impressions. Why don't I ask Taylor Pensno to go first? Tell me about your impressions of now what here in the state of Illinois we've been through over the past, month and a half.
Well, David, we've been through political trauma of the first magnitude, obviously. It's been marked by turmoil and uncertainty and political tragedy. Obviously, the governorship of or at least the ex-governorship of Rod Blagojevich is a political tragedy. We've been in the national spotlight first in glowing terms in the election of Senator Obama's president, but now, of course, that's been counterbalanced or maybe offset to some extent by the national folly, as it's viewed, of the whole Blagojevich incident. It's unfortunate, and I think that, the image of Illinois politically is probably at its lowest ebb, in spite of the presidency of Obama, is at its lowest ebb in my adult lifetime, and that's a darn shame. We've got, as you already said in your introductory remarks, we've got a long way to go here, and we face some major challenges.
Yeah. Well, Professor Redfield, what do you think?
I agree completely with all of that, and the only thing I would add is, before the 9th of December, state government was pretty much immobilized, and we were facing an unbelievable fiscal crisis as well as a moral crisis in terms of our ethics. Having the governor gone is a first step in terms of engaging those two problems, but we had about 2 seconds to kind of pause and reflect, and now what's facing us in the next three or four months is really daunting if we're going to get things back in shape, both in terms of our ethics laws, campaign finance laws, and then in terms of dealing with the horrendous problems in the state budget.
Well, let me ask you about that, and then Taylor Pensnock can also take a shot at it. One of the things that certainly struck me as I was listening yesterday evening to the brief press conference that Pat Quinn held. He took some questions from reporters a very short time after having been sworn in. We certainly know that the state of Illinois is in dire financial conditions, but one of the things I guess that struck me was that we apparently don't know precisely how big the state's deficit is. And I guess my question, I'm sure the question of a lot of people would be, well, how can that be? I mean, how can we not know what that number is?
Well, we have a huge amount of unpaid bills, and part of it depends on how you kind of calculate that. We have have been doing a lot of taking one-time money and paying ongoing operating expenses. We're going to have a revenue shortfall because sales tax, income taxes are down. We have to increase our payments to the pension system. And so, the number is probably staggering just in terms of balancing the budget for the year that's going to end July 1st and then trying to, or June 30th, and then trying to figure out where we are next year. And the comptroller, puts numbers out there in the, $4 and $5 billion range when you add all of these things up. And hopefully we're going to get a clear accounting and then make some hard decisions.
I have nothing to add to that. I agree with Kent. I would say to be a little fair to Blagojevich, he entered office 6 years ago, inheriting a big budget deficit from previous Governor George Ryan. And so he did start in a hole budgetary-wise. But what's happened, as Kent knows, is we've in his time, we greatly increased the state's indebtedness, both bonded and otherwise, and I think we're in even a bigger hole right now. Blagojevich, a hallmark of his administration was that under no circumstances would he ever consider or hear of any increases in two major revenue sources, meaning the income tax and the sales tax. And I'm certainly not here on the program indicating that those have to be looked at, but obviously I think they might be looked at. Most people think in terms of the big picture that Ken outlined, where are we going to go to begin to get the kind of revenue we need to close the gap?
Yeah, well, certainly that was one of the things that reporters asked Governor Quinn about yesterday. He certainly didn't take that on directly, but one has to wonder whether such a thing is just going to have to, people just going to have to hold their noses. They're not going to like it, but that some kind of maybe at least temporary tax increase, we'd have to at least think about that or talk about that.
Yes, it, what we're doing is not sustainable, and we're either going to have to start paying for things or we're going to have to stop doing things. And the things that we're talking about are not frivolous, waste and fraud kinds of items. Those are always there, but this is of the magnitude that it just isn't a little nip and tuck and trim. We have to make some very hard decisions about what kind of services the state's going to deliver, and then and how are we going to pay for them?
I have some other callers here. I want to promise these people I will not make them wait too much longer. But there is one other thing I'd like to ask each of you to talk about for a little bit, and that is say something about Pat Quinn. I think that probably people who follow Illinois politics, they know who Pat Quinn is. He's been a political activist in the state of Illinois for a long time. But I expect that now, when he was sworn in, that there were a lot of people in this state who would say, well, you know, I guess I don't really feel like I know who Pat Quinn is. Just as a way, I'll start with Taylor Pensino. You know, what do you think people should know about Pat Quinn?
This morning, I met Pat Quinn back in 1972, so I guess I've known him, 39 years. Where do you begin to talk about Pat Quinn? I think that this would be a good part of the program. If you ask me for adjectives, I was thinking Pat Quinn is at the same time witty, blunt, untiring, bright, but also abrasive, very aggressive. He's self-righteous. He's manipulative. He's very, very street smart, and that's important. And in the end, whatever he's tried to do, he's been effective. He's been a political maverick virtually his entire political life. We should remember that he is a protege of former Governor Dan Walker. He came out of what I always called the Walker movement, very much so. He was a key part of it. You know, basically, he's been a thorn in the side of the political establishments of both parties throughout his career. He's been a pariah because of his various initiatives, some of which were very effective, such as leading the move to get passage of the so-called cutback amendment back in 1980 that reduced the size of the House of Representatives. He was the one foremost responsible for CUB, the Citizens Utility Board, which gave more public oriented consumers representation before the Illinois Commerce Commission. As I think Kent knows, he's and this is an area Kent's very expertise in. He's constantly been in the forefront of efforts to get ethical reform in Illinois. He's sponsored for years with little success some of the time. All sorts of amendments to get things on the ballots to, you know, rein in legislative salaries, prevent double dipping by public officials. He's been many people call him a gadfly. That was a term back in my reporting days we always used to describe Quinn. He's very unpredictable. He's very unconventional. He's very much, I would say, a modern day populist. He's never swayed from that. And again, that comes out of the Walker mystique. And I think that it's kind of difficult to predict, or it's tricky to see exactly where we're going to go with a Quinn governorship. But you know, he's never been involved in scandal involving anything with public funds or anything of that nature. As I said, he's been very sterile. Even when he was state treasurer, you know, he didn't go in for a lot of security and all the perks that go along with the office. So, you know, we've got a very down to earth guy here, but a very smart guy. And a guy who basically has been a political maverick who's been very much anti-establishment.
All right. Well, Kent, you want to add? What
would you say? And, you know, all I would add is, you know, this is a person of ideas, a person that's effective in kind of mobilizing public opinion. He's been very good on environmental issues and on veterans affairs issues. What we don't know is, you know, how is he going to be as a manager for a $60 billion state budget and all of the thousands of employees the state of Illinois has? And even more importantly, you know, how is he going to be as someone who now has to go in and negotiate with the legislative leaders and get a budget and get things done? And so, you know, he's spent his whole career on kind of on the outside of power, trying to influence things. Now he's in the center of power. I mean, we found out from our ex-governor, no matter how bad you are, it's hard not to be powerful if you're governor of the state of Illinois. And so, So this is going to be a very interesting, two or three months as we kind of get the outline of what we are going to do about our budget and when is the 2010 election going to start? You know, are we going to have a timeout, or did it start this morning? Nobody knows for sure.
Yeah, our two guests this morning, Kent Renfield and Taylor Pencenow. Kent Renfield is professor of political science at University of Illinois. Taylor Pencenow, he's former Illinois State House political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and has also authored biographies of Illinois Governors Dan Walker, Richard Ogilvie. He's also served to update and revise Robert Howard's book, The Illinois Governors, Mostly Good and Competent. Questions certainly welcome. We have some people here who have been patient. I want to get right to them and start in with someone in Urbana on our line number two. Hello.
Hi. I've got two related questions. Yesterday, Governor Quinn mentioned that one of the things they're going to do is review to see if ex-Governor Blagojevich actually passed any other kind of legislation or did anything in the last few days. So I'd like to get the opinion of your guest to see what kinds of things could, a governor who's, facing pending impeachment do in their last days. And then secondly, what happened to Blagojevich once the vote was taken that he was going to be impeached? Did he have to drive himself home? Were state funds used to get him home? When did he leave the Capitol? Does anybody have any insight as to what happened to Blagojevich after the impeachment as well, too?
He apparently
left
right away before they actually took the vote to impeach, so he could, in fact, take the state plane home.
48-minute talk to the Senate. He was whisked out of the State House sort of by a side door, which is customary for him, or has been. And then I understand he was flown in a state plane back to Chicago and driven to his home.
And at that point, he still was the governor.
Right.
He was.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. That's true.
The moment the vote was announced, he was the ex-governor, and his security has been withdrawn. He no longer has, he's just a private citizen, essentially. They've already cleaned out his office and cleaned his things out of the mansion. There probably wasn't a lot to take, but as to what he was governor up until the time the roll call was announced. I think he issued a couple of clemency, did a couple of clemency petitions yesterday. He certainly could appoint people, to a board or a commission. There may be things that Governor Quinn could not rescind a pardon or a grant of clemency. He certainly could suspend an appointment or remove someone. So there are. I don't think he saw, they were not putting any laws on his desk. The legislature has not passed anything of substance in the new General Assembly, so he was not taking any of those kinds of actions.
Any Taylor, anything you'd want to, or that you know of that you'd want to add?
No, not really. I think Ken covered it. I know that he's indicated, or at least there's a lot of feelings downstate that they would like now Governor Quinn to certainly initiate a reconsideration of some things that Blagojevich did that have really rankled people down here, moving the Traffic Safety Division of IDOT down to Southern Illinois, his assistance on shuttering the Pontiac Prison, things like that. They're hoping that Quinn will revisit those issues and move also very quickly, and I think he maybe said he would, to try to reopen various state parks and historic sites that have been closed by Blagojevich, allegedly for budgetary reasons. I'm sure Flynn's desk is just going to be flooded with proposals from groups who haven't had a voice or haven't been heard in the Blagojevich years that now think that with Quinn we're going to get a reconsideration of things. And mm-hmm. And Quinn says he'll be very open-minded, and knowing him, I think he will be.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This is someone in Champaign in line number three. Hello.
Yes. In all the commentary about Blagojevich, I think news media people are losing track of one significant fact, which is that back in his days when he was congressman and speaking for the Serbian-American community in Chicago, he went over to Bosnia during the Serbian war of genocide and extermination against them, and met with Radovan Karadzic, who at the time was in the process of exterminating the Bosnians, had murdered about 100,000 of them, had raped about 20,000 women, and assisted Radovan Karadzic, technically rendering Blagojevich an accomplice. Today, Radovan Karadzic is on trial before the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague for genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And quite frankly, Blagojevich should be on trial there with him as an accomplice to Karadzic. And it simply was appalling to me that the Democratic Party here in the state of Illinois would run a presumptive war criminal for governor, because it is clear Blagojevich was never fit to be governor in the first place. And not only should he be prosecuted up there in the Northern District of Illinois, he should be prosecuted over in The Hague. And I don't understand why the commentators simply are overlooking the fact that this man was never fit for public office in the first place, because he's a presumptive war criminal. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's a piece of the story that I guess I'm not familiar with. Can you comment on that either?
The listener is certainly very well informed, and I must confess my ignorance about almost everything that he said. And he sounds like he really knows what he's talking about. The only thing I know that when Blagojevich was in Congress, I know that he was a backbencher and didn't get much attention and didn't do anything that got national press coverage. He did, though, in 1999, in underscoring his Serbian ancestry, he did accompany Reverend Jesse Jackson to Belgrade in the old Yugoslavia to negotiate the release of three captive American soldiers. I do remember that, and that was one of the few times when he was in Congress that he did get some national attention.
And we should be clear that, you know, whatever live, you know, whatever criminal exposure that the governor has, either in federal courts or internationally, the Illinois General Assembly is limited by the state constitution to two penalties. If, you know, one is the removal from office if you impeach someone, and then secondly, barring them from ever holding public office again in the state of Illinois. And they cannot do anything else. They cannot, they can't fine him. They can't put him in jail. There's nothing the legislature is empowered to do with the state constitution other than to remove him from office and bar him from holding any other public office, no matter what crimes he may or may not be guilty of. It was beyond the scope of the General Assembly to do anything other than just remove him from office and bar him from holding further public office.
All right, let's talk with Champaign County. Next caller, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I only have a moment, but I wanted to comment on Pat Quinn. I don't know how inadvertent this was, but in one of the quick press conferences or press opportunities he had, he used the expression for solidarity in Illinois, everybody in, nobody left out. That's the slogan for universal health care. Quinn's personal physician and advisor in some medical instances is Quentin Young, who's been physicians for universal health care for quite a while in Illinois. We have the junior senator now in the White House who took Simon's seat, Simon during the Clinton health care attempt, I'll call it, tried to get a bill in, and it was shot down by Big Pharma and the health care insurance industry quite quickly to allow states to individually try different programs, which possibly would include universal health care. So between that combination of things, I think maybe it's tilting at windmills, but now's the time for windmills, it seems. The other thing I can say about Blago is that his idea of no income tax increase as a sacred trust was, I think, silly, but the strictures of the Constitution are such that it's very hard to do anything to do equity in it. And I actually thought the gross receipts tax was poorly named. It should have been called the corporate fairness tax. It's not well reported in most papers in this state. the corporations pay very little tax to the state. Very, extremely. There was a study of this that was done by a State House reporter. I think it was never printed in a major paper, but it went in the Southtown Economist and small papers around the state that show that corporations are just really getting off the hook. So maybe Governor Quinn could come back with the corporate fairness tax, which would have elements of redressing that problem, because that would be a long step towards fixing the revenue. And I got to run. Thank
you. All right. Well, I don't know either. Kent, do you want to take a shot at that if you like?
Well, as far as health care is concerned, I think one of the reasons we're in horrendous problems is in Illinois is the governor tried to do it by himself, and some of it was illegal and some of it was not very, it's an illusion of access because nobody will take the people that we've expanded the eligibility for because the state won't pay its bills. If we're going to address health care, it's going to be a national rather than a state, individual state initiative. And so I whatever his intention was, the execution was terrible in terms of getting the state involved with expanding health care because we were doing things that we couldn't afford and it really was an illusion. So I think that it's not likely that we're going to be doing any new spending, any new programs in Illinois. That's going to have to be national. And the revenue structure of the state is a mess. There are limits in the Constitution. The income tax has to be flat. And corporate and individual income taxes are tied by a ratio of 8-5. You can't raise corporate income taxes without raising individual income taxes when if you're already at that ratio, which we are. And so, I think that's one of the problems of addressing our fiscal situation is there are some limitations in the state constitution.
I would add it that, Quinn has always been generally an advocate of universal health care through the years in his outsider role. I think, if I recall, he and his, at the time, personal physician or doctor marched over 100 miles across a part of Illinois in a grassroots effort to spur interest in a universal health care proposal. I believe that happened, if memory serves me right.
We're at our midpoint here. We have some other callers. Let me just very quickly introduce the guests. Last person you heard, that's Taylor Pensno. He's a former Illinois State House political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and is the author of a number of books, including biographies of Illinois Governors Dan Walker and Richard Ogilvie. He's also worked to update and revise Robert Howard's book, The Illinois Governors, Mostly Good and Competent. Also joining us is Kent Redfield. He's professor of political science at the University of Illinois, interim director for the Institute for Legislative Studies. His books include Money Counts, How Dollars Dominate Illinois Politics and What We Can Do About It, and Cash Clout, Political Money in Illinois Legislative Elections. And we're talking about where we stand now, talking a little bit about the impeachment of Rod Blagojevich, the fact that now we have a new governor and that he is confronted with, he and the legislature and all of us confronted with some pretty serious problems here in the state of Illinois. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign and line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a curiosity question. Since Blagojevich apparently spent most of his time, there at his in his home and ran the state out of his home. I'm saying this, I don't know how much he did that, but how are they going to get, I'm sure he's got papers there. How are they going to get the papers out of his house?
That'd be a logistical question. I don't know if I have an answer to that.
Have to
he,
I'm
sure there, the documentation of his performance as governor, of course, would go far beyond what he has personally. And there are many avenues for recording things that are done in the individual departments with the General Assembly, everything else. So, I would think that's an interesting question. But my guess is that would not be a problem. It's true that he basically ran the governor's office out of his own home in Chicago. He didn't live in a mansion here, as everybody knows. But in addition, I was told he spent very little time in the governor's office in the Thompson Center in Chicago. So.
That was what I wanted. So I wondered how he was able to do that without having his paperwork.
Well, he basically governed
by him.
By telephone, I understand.
I don't know. I mean,
from his home in Chicago, literally.
I mean, he's not exactly, somebody who's going to, I think, cooperate very easily, or at least he hasn't in the past.
Most governors really are not hands-on enough to worry about individual paperwork and things like that anyway. They have the staffs are very large, the gubernatorial staffs, and there are all sorts of people that basically handle paperwork, keep records, files, if they're going to be kept. Governors generally don't really personally are involved with preserving or filing or accumulating or organizing the paperwork surrounding their governorship.
There is an Official Records and Act, and certain things, have to be kept. I honestly don't remember whether the FBI executed a search warrant on his house or not. So, but my guess is that the way we get some of the governor's papers back is to ask the FBI if we can have them after they get done with them in the trial.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's try and get at least, I know, Kent, you have to leave us in about 5 minutes, so I want to make sure we get at least one more caller in here while you're still with us, and we'll do that by going to Champaign in line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah. It's really sobering to hear some of your guest comments relative to the state of our finances here in the state of Illinois. It seems to me that there's a pretty good challenge out there for the new governor and how we take care of the financial problems that we have here. And Pat Quinn mentioned yesterday reopening some of these state parks. That may be just a little bit premature, it seems to me, given our budget constraints.
I think he's, there's not a lot of money there. That's a symbolic thing. The governor shut them down to kind of signal, look how much trouble we're in. And Quinn will probably open them back up to say that, we're open for business again. And that's a little symbolic back and forth. It's like, when you got problems in the municipal budget, you always threaten to fire policemen and firemen, even though you really don't mean it. You're in a larger sense, you're exactly correct. We really don't know what our situation is, and that's very frrightening because we're not sure where we are currently, and the future is incredibly uncertain. And so I think we're going to, other than the little symbolic things like opening those parks, everything is going to be, we're going to be very restrained in what we do because we really don't know how bad, how much trouble we're in.
But it seems to me we need more straight talk. I mean,
yes.
This idea of saying that for political reasons, I think the people of Illinois need straight talk. We've had a lot of BS, and that's the reason why we got rid of our previous governor, because he certainly took advantage of the trust of the people of Illinois. I want straight talk, and I'm privileged to listen to you guys today because you guys are telling it like it is.
Let me just comment on that while we still got Kent with us, because sooner or later, I mean, many groups, AFSCME, other groups are going to be pressuring Quinn to call for an increase in the state income tax. That's my opinion. And, of course, at this point, obviously, he's noncommittal on it, as he has to be. But he's got about 2 years to sit in that governor's chair, and a major political decision for him is going to be whether or not to actually call for a significant increase in the income tax, because, we all know more revenue is needed. There's no argument there. But taking the bull by the horns is another matter, and really hardly any major office holders openly have espoused, if at all, even considering what everyone knows is necessary, a major tax increase. And the caller accurately says that people want straight talk, but at the same time, you know, we want all these problems addressed budgetary-wise, but polls do show that there's a reluctance among people who are polled to accept a tax increase to pay for those things. So Quinn, Ken, I think you agree, Quinn has, I think, a major challenge facing his governorship, assuming he will try to retain the office in the 2010 election, which I will predict at this point he will. As the weather call for a major tax increase, notably the income tax, because that could, as well intended as it is and as much as it's needed, that could make or break him politically.
Well, I agree that it's a tough decision, but I also, you know, when you talk with former Governor Edgar, who's on the with the Institute for Government and Public Affairs with the University of Illinois, you know, he says, you know, when he ran, he said, I'm not sure whether I'm going to make that temporary income tax permanent. And Neil Hardigan said, I will never make that temporary income tax permanent. And he claims his internal polling showed that didn't hurt him, that most people listened to Hardigan and didn't believe him. And so I think you need to talk straight with the citizens of Illinois. I think we don't give the people enough credit for being able to understand what's necessary and when you put the facts out in front of them.
Well, I know Professor Redfield, we got to let you go. I just want to say once again, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
I appreciate being on, and as always, I'm happy for the opportunity. And look forward to talking to you again.
Very good. Kent Redfield, he's professor of political science at the University of Illinois, interim director for the Institute for Legislative Studies, and has written a lot about Illinois politics and money in Illinois politics. And I just want to mention again, among his books, Money Counts, How Dollars Dominate Illinois Politics and What We Can Do About It, and also Cash Clout, Political Money in Illinois Legislative Elections. Also with us this morning and staying with us here for the remainder of the program, so we've got about 15 minutes left, is Taylor Pensino. He's someone who, like Kent Redfield, has been following Illinois politics for a long time. He's former Illinois State House political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He was there in that job for a dozen years. He's also written books, including biographies of former Governors Dan Walker, Richard Ogilvie, and also Illinois State Senator W. Russell Arrington, and he has also served to update and revise Robert Howard's book, The Illinois Governors, Mostly Good and Competent. And he's continuing with us here for the time that we have remaining. And we do have some other callers here, and we will go next to someone who is in Urbana, and I believe this would be line number one. Hello.
Hello. I heard that the budget has gone up $6 billion in the last 6 years, which is approximately a 15% increase. So if the legislators cannot operate within the constraints of their revenue, then more money is not going to do any good. Now, I wanted to comment on the voice vote. If you are a legislator and you're sitting there and 10 or 15 previous legislators that vote for you, I mean vote before you, vote one way, then you will feel compelled to go along to get along rather than to stand out, because if you dissent, then it's like you're saying to the other legislators they're wrong, and then you're in danger of being ostracized. So I think that is a faulty process of announcing your vote. It should have been done by secret ballot.
I think the caller raises a legitimate point, psychologically speaking, about the General Assembly and voting. It was obvious that the impeachment charges were going to be approved, and meaning Blagojevich was going to be convicted. So, therefore, after the vote was obvious, no senator obviously wanted, even if they inside had maybe some questions about whether he was getting a fair shake and all that. And they might have wanted to draw it out a little longer. They weren't going to buck the tide. He was going to be convicted, and so why go on record and maybe put their own reputations at peril in terms of what follows? But it's kind of an elephant herd philosophy. And again, the caller's right. The vote, you know, justified or whatever, was certainly bulldozed through, and nobody really wanted to stand out and cast a negative vote, or I guess you could vote present, but that didn't happen.
Would he have been allowed to bring witnesses and cross-examine any assertions that were made against him?
Oh, yes. Yes, sir. No, he was. He was given that opportunity, and he turned it down. Rules were drawn up for the conduct of the proceedings in the Senate, and he was given an opportunity to present witnesses and present a defense. It wasn't a court trial, but somewhat in a manner of a court proceeding. But, of course, you know, he chose to fly up to New York City and appear on various talk shows and plead his case there. And he said he didn't want to present any defense because he said it was fixed from the start. And apparently he knew accurately that he was doomed in the vote. And you know, he decided to boycott the whole proceedings. And then it was just at the last minute that he did request permission to address the senators, which he was allowed to do yesterday for, I guess he talked 48 minutes. But no, he had the opportunity to present a defense and to try to bring whatever witnesses he could summon, but he declined to do so.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let us go back here to, I think we have an earlier caller. Maybe you'd like to make a follow-up comment. This would be caller in Fisher. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, first of all, I would like to applaud the University of Illinois for being so involved in this. Also, one of the significant things I thought yesterday was that Blagojevich actually called everybody out. You know, as pathetic as his leadership is, he named names, and I would just like your opinion on that attempt of his to expose other people in this situation. And I'll get off the phone and listen to your response.
All right.
I think that's a good point, and it's a very dangerous point here in terms of state government. Blagojevich is cornered. He's like an animal caged. He's desperate. And to the political process and to parts of the establishment, he's dangerous. And I guess you might say he has nothing to lose right now. And you know, we all know that the various pay-to-play aspects that figured into his governorship, those are, of course, not relegated to just Rod Blagojevich. You know, that's employed to some degree from one end of the state to the other by office holders. George Ryan tried to plead and say he'd done nothing that previous governors hadn't done, and there was some truth to that. Blagojevich, of course, is going to mount the same line that, you know, he hasn't done anything that many others judging him have done. Now, the difference is Ryan didn't name names, but Blagojevich has already indicated that he is going to name names, and it's going to be interesting. You know, we're going to have a criminal trial coming up. We assume the criminal charge filed against him will lead to an indictment by the U.S. Attorney in Chicago. Therefore, there will be a trial, obviously, and that's going to be a whole different set of circumstances, and it's going to be interesting. The people he says he's going to, or indicates he's going to call in as witnesses for one reason or another, including, Rahm Emanuel, the new chief of staff for Obama. And Blagojevich is cornered and desperate, and therefore, he is a threat to try to impugn or inflict damage on the reputations of some other current major office holders in Illinois who probably have reason to be have some anxiety about how far Blagojevich is going to go in blowing the lid off the way we do business in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, some people have commented on one thing that the governor said when he made his statement before the senators yesterday, and the governor was talking about the tapes that were played during the proceedings. And we've all heard about the tapes.
Mm-hmm.
We have heard, or at least we've been told what's on the tapes.
Mm-hmm.
The only ones that actually at this point anybody's heard and the senators heard were these tapes that allegedly demonstrate his trying to shake down a racetrack owner for a campaign contribution in exchange for signing a bill that would benefit horse racing in the state.
Right.
And he said something in response to that. He said something to the other senators, something to the effect of, well, you know, this is just the way we do politics. politics. That's the kind of stuff we have to do to raise money. And I think that some people, when they heard that, said, you know, not only would some legislator, all legislators, I'm sure, like to distance themselves from a remark like that, but that they'd said that, you know, that when it does indeed come around time for his trial, that's not going to help him. That remark will be brought back and said, here, if essentially he is admitting to that very thing with which he is being charged.
Well, good point. There's no question he has been a leading practitioner of the pay-to-play politics in Illinois, and that's probably going to doom him or put him up against a real wall in his federal criminal trial, which is sure to come up in Chicago. But as you said, David, it may not help him. But in defending himself, if he calls into question or points out other examples of such in an effort to show he's not alone, it may again impugn or may bring names, big names, political names, into the trial, into the testimony, that names of individuals who really would not want to be associated with the that situation. You know, I mean, when you mentioned the horse racing industry, I remember I covered a lot of that back in my Post-Dispatch days, and it was pretty common for the major operators of tracks to be major political contributors to governors and other major officials. I mean, that's legendary in Illinois, and it's just that, you know, the practice has caught up big time with Blagojevich. The thing about Blagojevich is that he didn't camouflage or disguise his performance as such. You know, he's very open about it. He's very flippant about it. He's very glib, and he wasn't subtle at all, and there was kind of a cockiness or arrogance or maybe stupidity, but for whatever reason, you know, he laid himself out there for exposure and pummeling on the issue. But again, you know, having been around Illinois politics for so long of a time, he certainly is not alone in soliciting campaign contributions for what, in effect, you know, become favors, favorable legislation, favorable administrative actions, and so on.
Yeah. Another caller here. Let's talk with them while we still have some time. This is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering, I mean, something I've been wondering is, you know, the governor was arrested a month ago or a little more than a month ago, but it's still not been indicted. I don't know if you have any insight onto why he has not yet been indicted and why they arrested him so far before they were ready to issue an indictment.
Well, again, it's a good question. Number one, I don't personally have any more insight than you do, sir, or David. The arrest was triggered by the fact that in the continual tape recording of his conversations, apparently all around the state, in addition to Chicago, it was obvious, or appeared to be obvious, that he was, as has been reported, that the vacant Senate seat left by Obama it was up for sale. And I think that the U.S. Attorney's motive there in taking an unusual step of arresting him without an indictment and of publicizing the reason for the arrest was to prevent perhaps a worse situation down the line when it would become scandalous that whoever did get the Senate seat, things would be brought out that indicated he or possibly she had paid for it, and I think it was an attempt by Attorney Fitzgerald to preclude that situation from happening. Now, obviously, an indictment has to follow the criminal complaint. We can't be left in limbo. And as you said, it's interesting that Fitzgerald has asked for an extension of time to prepare his case to buttress the indictment. And apparently, obviously, the case is not solid, or he doesn't have all his ducks in order in terms of prosecuting Blagojevich. I don't know what other conclusion we can draw from that.
Yeah, I think, again, my understanding what everybody has said is I think we are expecting an indictment. The the time frame that has been mentioned is April.
Right.
And then I guess we would expect there to be a trial sometime this year, but when it might start, I suppose nobody really knows.
No, nobody does. And as you know, in a case of this magnitude and at this level, there'll be umpteen motions filed to delay this, to allow time for more accumulation of evidence. I mean, you know, we could be, you know, this thing could be drawn out over the next year to 2 years.
Mm-hmm. All right. Back to Champagne caller here, line one. Hello.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up.
I'm not naive enough to not recognize that I certainly don't want my taxes to go up. My point earlier is that we do need straight talk. The reality is, how do we resolve our budget problems? And I appreciate the guest's comments, because I think he supported my thought. We do need straight talk, even if the talk is not what we necessarily want to hear as to the avenues that we take to get out of the problem that we're in from a fiscal standpoint.
Well, I think, again, the caller, I think, hit it on the nose, and you answered your own question, obviously, and I agree with your analysis. We need straight talk. However, a number of major officials, policymakers, shy away from straight talk because they have big-time fears of alienating the electorate. And although the most ready answer, obvious answer, to the budgetary woes is a significant tax increase, you know, there's still a hesitation among the major players, the policymakers, to take the lead in advocating such because they fear, they fear repercussions. Nobody has ever forgotten the example of former Governor Richard Ogilvie, who in his first year in office called for and was granted the passage of the state income tax. And, you know, there's no question that he thought by doing it in his first year in office that 3 years later, when he ran for election, people would have forgotten, but they didn't. And every analysis showed in the end that Ogilvie failed to win re-election in 1972 because of a smoldering resentment over his passage of the state income tax.
Well, I want to thank the caller. We're just about at the end of the time. I just wanted to ask you something. This is an historical question. It's a little bit before your time, my time too, but I thought it was interesting that yesterday when the reporters asked Pat Quinn, Governor Quinn, if there were particular governors from Illinois' past that he admired, the guy that Quinn came up with was John Peter Altgeld. And I suppose that would send everybody running to their history books to look up Governor Altgeld and to find out something about him. I just wonder what you think about that.
I didn't hear the comment, but it's very interesting. John Peter Altgeld was in the late 1800s, I think in the 1890s, a Democrat, an early so-called liberal Democrat, was not part of the party establishment at all, was kind of a maverick, was very independent, very unconventional, very unpredictable. And, of course, you know, everyone remembers him for issuing the pardon for a number of the so-called Haymarket rioters up in Chicago. And that was a very unpopular thing at the time, and he suffered for it. And I'm pretty sure he was a one-term governor. He didn't get real. I'm not sure he even ran for election. But the point is, that's interesting because John Peter Altgeld would be the sort of unconventional, unbridled governor that I would predict Quinn is going to be. And so that's interesting that he did compare himself or did bring up the name of John Peter Altgeld.
Yeah. Well, at that, we will have to finish up with our thanks to our guest, Taylor Pensnaw. Again, he spent 12 years as the Illinois political correspondent of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's the author of Governor Richard Ogilvie in the Interest of the State and also co-author of Dan Walker, The Glory and the Tragedy. The Sun-Times called the Ogilvie book one of the 10 most notable political books of 1997, both of them awarded the Illinois State Historical Society Certificate of Excellence. Guys, been around Illinois politics and been watching Illinois politics for a long time. Taylor Pensnaw, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.
Support for the broadcast today comes from New Prairie Construction, serving the Champaign-Urbana area since 1988. They specialize in remodeling, additions, historic restoration, and straw bale construction. You can learn about New Prairie Construction on their website, newprairieconstruction.com. Support also comes today from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. That is it for us. Up next, though, is the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we're going to take a look at the relationship between personal history and political leadership. We'll go to the archives and rebroadcast an interview with historian William Chafe, author of Private Lives, Public Consequences, Personality and Politics in Modern America. That will follow the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. March wheat is trading at 6.11 and 3 quarters, up 3 and 3 quarters. May, 6.23, up 4. In Chicago, March wheat, 5.83, up 5. May, 5.94 and a half, up 3 and a half. March corn, 3.84, up 2 and a quarter. May, 3.95, up 2. July, 4.06, up 2 and a quarter. September, 4.16, up 2. March beans, 9.84, up 13 and a half. May, 9.91, up 13 and a quarter. July, 10.01, up 16. March meal, 3.12.70, up $4. March oil, 32.67, up 30. At the Merck in Chicago, February live cattle, 81.80, up 70. April, 84.80, up 47 and a half. March feeder cattle, 90.85, up 22 and a half. April, 91.90, up 25. February lean hogs, 58.40, up 140. Outside markets, March crude, 41.90, up 46. The U.S. dollar, 86.03. That's up 56. The CRB index, 221.02. Up 97. The Dow off 72, the NASDAQ down 13, and the S&P 500 is off 8. It's noon Central Time. This is WILL 580.